Anyway, Peter's setting up. So Peter's a philosopher, works part-time for Damaris, part-time...
Here, there and everywhere. Well, not everywhere, but here and there. Yes. I'm coming at this from the background of a philosopher who's by no means an expert in the creation myths of other cultures, so it was fun to do some research on this, but I can't claim any expertise on this, although many years ago I did do an A-level in classical Greek thought. Myth is an easily misunderstood term in our culture. If you talk about myth, I think many people immediately think you're talking about some sort of fantasy world story. But here's a couple of dictionary definitions of myth that show that we're not necessarily talking about something that is by definition a false story. A traditional, typically ancient story dealing with supernatural beings, ancestors or heroes that serves as a fundamental type in the worldview of a people, as by explaining aspects of the natural world or delineating the psychology, customs or ideals of a society. Then a myth is a traditional or legendary story, especially one that involves gods and heroes and explains a cultural practice or natural phenomenon. And a myth is a usually traditional story of ostensibly historical events that serves to unfold part of the worldview of a people or explain a practice, belief or natural phenomenon. In a very loose sense, reading through those, you could actually say that contemporary Big Bang cosmology could qualify as a myth, which is not to say that contemporary Big Bang cosmology is false, but it is something that functions as part of our ostensibly historical explanation for certain natural phenomena and so on. It helps us situate our understanding of ourselves within the world that we find ourselves in. When we're talking about a myth, though, usually we're not talking about science. After all, science as a subject didn't exist back in the day when the kind of myths that we're talking about here came into being. But neither are we talking about mere flights of fancy. I think we have to situate our thinking somewhere between those two bookends, as it were. At the very least, myth provides a sort of narrative story framework that resonates with an audience, that helps them to situate themselves within this myth's framework of understanding reality. So there is something there about an attempt to understand and to conceptualize our place in the world. And as such, myths, at the very least, contain elements of metaphysical, if not scientific, understanding that we can and should critically assess. So let's go through a number of different ancient creation myths and compare and contrast with the biblical creation myth. Here's a little summary of the Egyptian creation myth. The world emerged from Nu, an infinite sea of chaos. Some represented the inherent qualities of Nu as eight different gods who were depicted as aquatic creatures that lived within Nu. The first thing to emerge from Nu was a pyramid-shaped mound of earth. The sun god Ra arose, whether directly or indirectly, from this mound in the form of, well, some said a heron or a falcon or a beetle or a child. And some attributed the cosmic order of the world to a particular god, be it Atman or Ptah, who emerged from Nu and formed pre-existent materials into the form of the world that we have today. So the Egyptian creation myth begins with a brute fact of an impersonal chaos, Nu, from which the present cosmic order emerges. There's no definite beginning to the cosmic order per se, it's just there. The present cosmic structure, as we see it around us, is explained either as an unintentional process, the result of an unintentional process, or, for some, the product of intelligent design by a finite kind of demiurge kind of god conception who imposes form onto pre-existing materials. And so reality as a whole is conceived of as a brute fact. The Babylonian creation myth from the, if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, Enuma Elish, describes the time when only Apsu, the primeval sweetwater ocean, and Tiamat, the saltwater ocean, existed, along with their son, Mamu, who seems to represent the mist rising from the two bodies of water and hovering over them. The god Ea and the goddess Daimkai produce a child called Marduk, and many of his fellow gods make him the elect him the sort of supreme god in a pantheon, a polytheistic pantheon of gods. His rival was Tiamat, and Marduk kills Tiamat and then splits her immense body in two, using one half of the corpse to fashion the sky and the other half to fashion the earth. Here's a picture of Marduk chasing Tiamat. So in the Babylonian creation myth, we begin with the coexistence of three finite water gods who aren't clearly personal, but they perhaps straddle what we think of as the distinction between natural and supernatural in a sort of pantheistic manner, almost, before we get introduced to a pantheon of finite gods. There's no beginning to the cosmic order, per se. The cosmic structure around us now is explained as the result of one god killing and intentionally reshaping the pre-existent body of another god. So no ultimate account is given for the existence of any of these finite gods beyond their dependence on some other gods upon those. So the whole thing is, again, a brute fact. Within the Greek creation myth, taking most of this from Hesiod's Theogony, the origin of the gods. Originally, there is only chaos, which is a bit of a misleading term or translation. We think sort of chaoticness just meant chasm or void. This chasm existed, and out of the chasm of chaos emerged Gaia, the earth, and other various finite gods, including, for example, Eros. Gaia gives virgin birth to Uranus, the sky, who then fertilizes Gaia, who then gives birth to six male and six female titans, and so on, and then we end up with films like Clash of the Titans. So basically, there's a lot of transgressive sex and cannibalism and war and mutilation and a general lack of wholesome family values. That's to cut a long story short. So within the Greek creation myth, the cosmic order per se, again, is a brute fact. There's no clear beginning to the cosmic order per se. The present cosmic order is the product of a natural, in inverted commas, process. This process just happens to what was already there. No ultimate account is given for the existence of any of these finite gods beyond their sexual reproductive dependence on others. And reality as a whole is a brute fact. The Chinese creation myth. In the beginning, there was no clear distinction between heaven and earth. It was all one gooey mess surrounding a big black egg. Curled up inside the egg was Pangu. Pangu slept inside the egg for 18,000 years. When he finally awoke, he wanted to escape. So he picked up his axe and hewed his way out. Some of the contents of the egg were heavy and sank to become the earth. Some of them were light and floated up to become the sky. The earth and the sky then swelled at a rate of 3 meters a day for another 18,000 years. And the fleas on Pangu's body evolved into being people, and so on. So within the Chinese origin myth, we begin with the coexistence of an unstructured, impersonal physical reality and a sleeping personal agent. There's no real beginning to the cosmic order per se. There might be a sort of hint of it in talking about the time which Pangu slept, but it's certainly not emphasised. The cosmic structure is explained as, again, the unintended natural side effect of the activity of a finite supernatural agent. And there's no ultimate account given for the existence of either impersonal matter or personal agency. Reality as a whole is just a brute fact. Within the biblical creation myth, just to jog the memory, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was an evening, and there was morning the first day, and so on. Now, Genesis, of course, is not the only passage about creation in the Bible. When we're talking about the biblical creation myth, that is one passage that feeds into that story. But there's lots of passages, as was mentioned in the previous talk as well, in Psalms, in Isaiah, and so on, and in the New Testament, passages like the beginning of John's Gospel, for example. The biblical creation myth, what are the similarities to these other creation myths? Well, in all of these myths, there's a development in the cosmic order. It goes from an order that doesn't have life, as we see it today, to one that does have life as we see it today. As with the Babylonian and some versions of the Egyptian myths, the Bible attributes this development to intelligent design rather than to nothing but natural processes. I phrase that carefully. Like the Babylonian myth, the Bible references water. But again, in the realm of myth here, this is not to be taken literally, necessarily, as in any of these. But we're talking about a sort of proto-cosmos before it has the form that we see around us today. But this proto-cosmos is a created, non-divine reality within the biblical myth. Like the Babylonian myth, the Bible makes reference to three divine persons. Indeed, the hints of that in Genesis are made very explicit elsewhere in the Bible, of course. And one of these divine persons even hovers over the waters, interestingly. But the biblical myth is presented very firmly within a context of monotheism rather than a context of polytheism, which begins bringing us on to the differences. The biblical myth begins with the personal and not the impersonal, which is differentiates it from quite a lot of the stories that we looked at. We have a Trinitarian monotheism, not polytheism. The ultimate fact is a non-finite, wholly supernatural, personal deity who transcends the created cosmic order. The primal cosmos is not a brute fact within the biblical story, but was created by God. The cosmic order per se, not merely its present form with life, had a clear beginning within the biblical myth. And both the existence and form of the cosmic order, both past and present, is explained with reference to the intentional creative activity of one transcendent God. And God here functions as the uncreated creator who isn't merely a brute fact. Particularly think of Exodus 3:14, where God revealing himself in the burning bush talks about his name, his essence, his character as I am who or that I am. I'm the God whose very nature is to exist. Thomas Aquinas here distinguished famously between truths known by unaided human reason and truths known by faith, by which he didn't mean blind trust, but trust in divine revelation for good reason. And he, As William Carroll puts it, thought that it was a matter of biblical revelation that the world was not eternal. He didn't think you could prove through unaided human reason that the world had a beginning, but that we could know this from revelation. He also thought that the universe, even if it weren't to have a temporal beginning to it, it would still be something that needed to depend upon God for its very being, its existence. That it, you couldn't just say, oh, it's just a brute fact. It was the kind of thing that needed an explanation out of outside of itself. We've already had one mention of Leibniz today. This ties in with Leibniz's famous version of the cosmological argument from the principle of sufficient reason. The idea that everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, whether that's in something outside of itself or within its very nature. Going back to thinking of God saying, I am that I am. And you can, given a couple of other principles, very swiftly deduce a cosmological argument from God. Of course, within our modern scientific understanding of these things is the atheist cosmologist Alexander Vilenkin, who recently said that all the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. Fascinating editorial appeared in New Scientist reporting on the conference at which Vilenkin said that, which was the conference in celebration of Stephen Hawking's 70th birthday. And they said in this New Scientist article that the Big Bang is now part of the furniture of modern cosmology. Many physicists have been fighting a rear guard action against it for decades, largely because of its theological overtones. If you have an incident of creation, don't you need a creator? Well, cosmologists thought they had a workaround. They've tried on several different models of the universe that dodge the need for a beginning while still requiring a Big Bang, like saying, well, maybe there was a whole series of previous Big Bangs, oscillatory models and so on. But recent research has shot them full of holes. It now seems certain that the universe did have a beginning. Without an escape clause, physicists and philosophers must finally answer a problem that's been nagging at them for the best part of 50 years. How do you get a universe complete with the laws of physics out of nothing? Well, it's interesting to note that Thomas Aquinas knew that the universe had a beginning because he trusted the testimony of divine revelation, even though he didn't think you could prove this through unaided human reason. Unaided human reason seems to have proved Thomas Aquinas wrong on this point, but right on the fundamental point that he believed through revelation. Which of these myths at the metaphysical level most fits with the way we think about things today, from science, from philosophy? Well, scientifically, we see that the primeval cosmic order had a finely tuned potentiality for life. And that seems to rule out the Greek and the Chinese myths. But this potentiality was a necessary rather than a sufficient condition for life. And that points to intelligent design, I would argue, in the proto-cosmos, which rules out the Egyptian, Greek and Chinese myths. Philosophically and scientifically, I think we see that the cosmos had a beginning a finite time ago. And that rules out, pretty clearly, I think, all but the biblical myth. There might just be a hint in that Chinese myth. Philosophically, I think we can argue with Leibniz that we need more than just a brute fact label for reality. That is, a putting off of having any explanation, saying, well, there is no explanation, it's just there. That doesn't sit well with what Leibniz would argue is a foundational principle of rational argument, the principle of sufficient reason. And if you follow that, then you would rule out all but the biblical myth. So the level of those metaphysical things that myth is talking about, although it's not attempting to be modern science or even a sort of modern natural philosophy of the world, I think there are elements there that we can rationally assess, and where we can, it's interesting, but I think all of the data points towards the biblical myth being the one that stacks up best against what we might argue today from contemporary philosophical and scientific knowledge.
Thank you very much, Peter. More things to talk about, to chew on.
You didn't mention the myth of Adam and Eve. Moment, but I guess you include that as part of the creation myth of how humans began to be formed and are here.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also interested in, do you think what we call theology or metaphysics is actually myth? In other words, Paul talks about Christ as the second Adam. He's creating is a, perhaps you could argue that it's theology, but in fact it could be a mythology where he's put in the sort of symbolic Adam who comes back to redeem the world in the form of Christ, the cosmic Christ, and so on.
Yeah.
So he's actually talking about mythology, not... He's talking about mythology, not theology or metaphysics.
Yeah, I think it's probably hard to draw airtight lines of demarcation between these things. I would argue from a philosopher's science angle, for example, that it's actually hard to draw airtight lines of demarcation between what is science and what is philosophy. I would say, well, you know, science used to be part of philosophy, it's natural philosophy. There isn't really a hard and fast line here. We're thinking in terms of the spectrum of how we try and conceive of and understand reality. And we do that in sometimes more or less sort of mythopoetic ways. So, yeah, I think Paul is drawing upon a mythic typology to explain, to help us get a grasp on the importance of who Jesus is and to situate him within our understanding of reality. But that's neither to say that he's using a sort of, you know, logical positivist kind of empiricist language about hard facts known through empirical means only at one extreme, or that it's just a matter of, well, just, you know, whatever story floats your boat, it's all fantasy anyway, everyone has their story at the other. I think really we're somewhere between these two extremes, and we have a sort of spectrum of ways of talking about and conceiving reality that have their own methods of being critical and sensible about them that keep us grounded in terms of actually thinking, well, yeah, we are actually talking about realities here.
Question over there.
The thing I take away from the story of creation isn't really the idea of sort of God grabbing things. It's actually the surprising chronological accuracy which there is. God doesn't create man on the first day and then create the waters and then create the beasts and all that.
Yeah.
It's actually, from a scientific point of view, it's probably very accurate. Mm. He creates the waters and the heavens, the earth, and beasts of the sea and so forth, and at the end he creates man. So
yeah. Yeah.
Although it says that he does it for 7 days and rests on the seventh, there's actually, if you compare it to science, there's just a remarkable similarity there.
That is an interesting point, and I think that comes into this whole discussion about, okay, Genesis as a creation myth is not trying to be a modern scientific textbook. But neither is it just, can it be dismissed as just a story? It is about trying to conceptualise an understanding of how we got here. And so at what points is it sensible to try to compare that kind of way of understanding reality against modern ways of thinking about how we understand reality? And see where is it sensible to try and use these sort of different ways and linking them up so that we can make assessments about them in modern terms, as it were.
I think there's part of it which seems so obviously sort of fantasy and wrong, and there's also part of it which seems so incredibly solid and actually proved by science.
That's right. So I think that's why it becomes a very interesting discussion about really understanding the kind of literature, the kind of, when it's making a truth claim, when it's making a sort of mythopoetic, not pushing it beyond the limits of its own kind of literature, but also not dismissing it as, oh, well, that's all just myth, and now we have science, you know. I don't think that's an either-or choice. I think it's a very complex both-and choice.
I think others have pointed out, too, the first 3 days of creation are largely a forming, a making of the cosmos on the Earth, and the last 3 days are a filling.
Yeah.
A putting of animals and plants and sun and moon and you and me here.
So it's talking about that, you know, there's a structure to reality, a purpose to reality that is there on account of agency. It's certainly attributing to an agency of a particular kind rather than to natural processes or to polytheistic agents. Talking something about the transcendent. It is talking about truth claims, but it's not quite the same truth claims that you're going to be finding when you look up a book on chemistry or oceanography or planetary formation. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just a quick one. Did you say, in fact, that only the biblical gave a distinction between heaven and earth, where heaven is God's realm,
and Earth is the world that we experience. Because that seems, most of the others, they were just extrapolating from where we are and led to all sorts of anomalies, because these guys inside their eggs, suddenly their head.
Yes, yeah.
So that, but it seems to me that perhaps the biblical, what distinguishes it is that it gives us a reference point outside.
Absolutely, yes. There's clear. The other myths, you kind of start where we are and you sort of work your way backwards and say things must have been different back in the day than they are now. And there's been a process of development, and here's a myth to tell how that came about. But yes, I think it's only within the biblical creation story that you get this clear sense that the cosmos is to be accounted for in terms of a God who transcends the cosmos, the heavens and the earth. That God is outside of that whole process and the existence of the whole thing that the other myths are talking about. And they usually attribute the development to natural processes within the world, or to finite agents who are part of the proto-cosmos, who then shape the cosmos to be different later on. But they're in a continuation with kind of the world, and there isn't this sense of the transcendent God creating the world. I think you're right about that, yeah.
I'll take one last question.
Very quick one, Keith. Do we look at creation as being an event that's finished, or do we look at something that God started and is still going on? Because if we take the latter view, it's quite different from the Babylonian and the ancient myths, which would have said it happened.
Well, going back to the first talk, of course, within the biblical understanding, we have this looking forward to the new heavens and the new earth, which has always been the goal. It's not like, you know, heavens and earth one is God's plan, and then it all mucked up and he had to come up with plan number two because he hadn't foreseen those consequences. The whole story heads towards this promise of the new heavens and the new earth. And so we have Christ's resurrection being talked about as the first sample, the first fruits of the new creation. And the whole creation, says Paul, groans in expectation of the revelation of the freedom of the sons of God in the train of Christ, when the whole universe gets transformed in the new heavens and the new earth. Yeah, so there's again, this forward-looking perspective is also, I think, something you don't get in the other creation myths.
I'm going to draw to a close, and we'd always said we'll stop at six, just a few minutes.
Thank you.
Can we thank both of our speakers?